Make your voice heard in Washington, D.C. Join us and many others for the next NFXF Fragile X Advocacy Day 2012, March 6th and 7th. Details available online at fragilex.org.
So I'm just going to go ahead and say good morning, everyone. Welcome to the podcast by the National Fragile X Foundation. And we are honored today to have some wonderful guests. We have Laureen Majeski from the Michigan Fragile X Group and a parent. We have Jane Dixon Weber, another parent and a staff member of the National Fragile X Foundation, our support services coordinator, and we have the famous Mouse and Tracy from Developmental Fragile X, also in Colorado, and they are going to be talking about the very important topic of self-regulation across the lifespan on this National Fragile X Foundation podcast for families. And I'm just going to start by asking the guests, whoever wants to volunteer first, to define self-regulation.
That is a great question and a hard thing to define. You know, we think about self-regulation in so many ways across many different ages of the lifespan. But sort of in general, we think about self-regulation as a person's ability to seek out comfort, or security or safety when they need that. So that's kind of a really broad definition. And one of the things that we want to try to accomplish in the podcast is to really break that definition down and talk about self-regulation in really specific ways and very specific to Fragile X. So we're going to talk about it both from a parent perspective, and then also kind of from a professional perspective, both what it is and what you have to do to develop the skills that give you the ability to seek that comfort when you need it.
Great. That explanation was very, very helpful. Can I assume that there is an emphasis on the self-regulation? The internal ability to self-regulate, not have others necessarily managing your environment.
Yeah, definitely. Really what the goal is in life is for the person themselves to be able to self-regulate. And part of that means that they have an awareness of what's happening inside of them that's causing them distress, and then that they would have the tools to be able to manage that level of stress or discomfort that has occurred. So what's interesting about that, Robbie, is that, you know, in little tiny kids or in individuals that are struggling with difficulties learning skills or learning language or learning about the world, sometimes there is a reliance on others. So in the early stages of regulation development, we actually use this term co-regulation. And that really talks about how, like, a parent soothes a baby, or if you have a toddler who's having a temper tantrum, how the parent kind of knows both how to offer comfort and also offer some limits around having that child kind of get it together. So self-regulation is both the comforting skill and also kind of that capacity that people have to organize themselves when there is stress happening. And so it starts with co-regulation.
I want to ask our two parents on the call why this is an important topic to them.
Well, I know that for myself, my children are starting to get a little bit older. They're in their late teens, and my daughter is 21. And I noticed a big difference from when they were in high school and they had a lot of people helping them and now they're going to a work-study program, and they don't have as many people helping them, and they're expected to go out into the community, and they have jobs that they have to do, and it's no longer, you know, one-on-one or one-on-three people. And I could see my kids struggling, and I didn't really know how to help them when they got to a job site. You know, I wanted them to be able to walk into a place and be able to function there. You know, when it's little and you take them into a store and it's the fluorescent lights, you know, the co-regulation, I never heard it called that, but that's exactly what we do. We soothe and comfort them. Well, now they're here on their own. They're expected to walk in, and they have to navigate that system by themselves. And I didn't really know how to teach them to do that. So I felt like it was really an important subject that needed to be addressed.
Laureen, that sounds like a very familiar problem that a lot of parents have. And as our children, whether they have Fragile X or not, develop, we assume that they're going to develop these self-regulatory skills on their own. And no one really teaches it to people. We don't teach it to our children, and we don't teach it to individuals with Fragile X. But it's so important that we recognize how important the self-regulatory skills are for people such like your children as they move into a more independent setting, and how integral it is to their success there.
Right, exactly.
This is Jane. I just wanted to throw in, going back to the co-regulation aspect and kind of the approach that we took after I did all of the readings, reading the material that you created, is, you know, we would introduce Ian, say, like, to a therapy ball. And so we tried to figure out the types of activities that he really liked or that seemed to be calming for him. And then initially, when we saw his anxiety go up, for example, we might say, you know, while I'm working here in the kitchen, why don't you bounce on your ball, you know, sit and bounce on a therapy ball while I fix lunch. And so I could see it happening in him, and so I would encourage him to do one of these activities. And now over time, because he's older too, he's 23, we have these opportunities to do these kinds of things around the house. We have swings in our front yard and our backyard. We have a therapy ball. We have, he likes to wear, you know, it used to be a weighted vest. Now he wears his tool belt. And so he tends to, over time, we've watched him seek out those kinds of things when he needs them, when it appears he needs them. But there are still times when he needs a little prodding. But it's very effective.
I'm sorry.
Go ahead, Laureen.
I was just going to say, I guess my question is, as you take those things, Jane, and then how do you, when they have to go out into an independent situation, how can they carry that, what they've learned, to that next step, that next stage?
Well, and I'm fortunate in that, so he works at our local grocery store, and he bags groceries. And about a year ago, they asked if he could learn how to do the carts, he could bring the carts in from outside. And, oh, my gosh, I jumped at that opportunity. So now, I mean, in this case, we happen to have just really some natural supports there. He does carts, so he's pushing and pulling six carts for an hour. Then he goes in and bags groceries. Then he goes back outside for an hour and does carts again, and then comes back in and bags groceries. And so that is a tricky one because, in my case, I happen to have those activities built into what he does.
That's fantastic. And, you know, what you've done there is you've really created a structure where he gets the kind of input that kind of helps him to self-regulate. And so it's both the structure and the predictability of that, and then also the sensory-based heavy work that he's getting provide that background beat that kind of help him to feel more organized and to be able to self-regulate. But I think it's a really important question, Laureen, because what happens is that there are lots of layers of skill development that we're kind of hinting at here.
you know, there's the issue of kind of learning how to do something in that co-regulatory way where mom or a teacher or a therapist or even a sibling might be guiding the person with Fragile X to choose the things that are going to help them to soothe and calm. And that's because somebody else is identifying it and then kind of providing a suggestion. But the other skill then is really how do I know how to use that when the person isn't suggesting it to me? And, you know, those are skills that take many years usually to acquire. So we think it's important for kids in as early as elementary school really to start to have self-regulation skills be just as important as any other skill they're learning, whether it be math or reading or, you know, a life skill like, you know, showering or money use or anything like that. Because really, being out in the world requires an extraordinary amount of self-regulation, and it takes a long time to learn all these layers of skill.
So I want to just remind everybody that they're listening to the podcast on self-regulation across the lifespan. I think I neglected to properly introduce everybody at the beginning, so I just want to say again that we have parent and leader from the Michigan Fragile X organization, Laureen Majeski, NFX staff member, Jane Dixon Weber. Both Laureen and Jane are parents. We have Tracy Stackhouse, occupational therapist, and Sarah Mouse Scharfenacker, speech and language therapist from Developmental Fragile X in Colorado, and I am Robbie Miller, Executive Director of the National Fragile X Foundation. Jane, I think you also had some questions.
Well, I was going to ask Tracy if she would talk a little bit more about that, about how it's an issue in Fragile X syndrome and what kinds of things they see and maybe why we see this issue in children who have Fragile X syndrome.
Sure. So what's interesting about people with Fragile X kind of characteristically is that they are very prone to anxiety, and an associated problem that's even more fundamental is that their nervous systems get overstimulated very easily, and then they're overactive. And that pattern we refer to, you'll read about that in things written about Fragile X, as hyperarousal. So hyperarousal is really a problem where there's too much activity in the brain, and then there's too much activation of the brain circuitry, and then the circuitry builds these different skills, things like your attention and your activity level and your emotional state and your organization of behavior. And those, each of those different functions, when you are hyper-aroused, are disrupted. So we see people with Fragile X sort of generally having problems with hyper-arousal, and then individually, people with Fragile X are going to have variation in how that shows itself. But sometimes it's, you know, really pervasive, and they really struggle with every aspect of hyper-arousal. And then they can be very overwhelmed and overstimulated much of the time. And then there are others who just, the hyperarousal just affects their language skills or their attentional skills. Or it might drive them to more activity, or maybe they're a little more emotionally labile, like they have more variability. And so sometimes they get a little upset more quickly, and they don't calm down as easily. So that's a lot of words to talk about hyperarousal, and we see that as a really significant and central problem for people with Fragile X. So what do you do about hyperarousal? You know, you really have to understand that in the background beat of that, it's a biological mechanism, and the biology of Fragile X is, you know, complicated, and we're all in the phase of learning so much about it with the advent of these new targeted treatments that everybody buzzes about all the time. But there isn't, you know, a medication or a biological intervention specifically that will manage the hyperarousal globally for people with Fragile X. And so we have to look at if we can't change it in a fundamental way biologically, what are we going to do about it? And the base of that is really about self-regulation, teaching self-regulation skills and putting in place self-regulation supports so that the hyperarousal is better managed.
And in managing the hyperarousal, we really believe that it takes a team approach with a combination of therapists and professionals at school, as well as parents and others that work directly with these kids, because everyone has to understand and recognize those signs of developing hyperarousal. Because, as Tracy mentioned, we know that hyperarousal has a significant effect on language as well. And we can see that when kids become more hyper-aroused, that it's harder for them to access the language that they have and that they tend to shut down a little bit. We can also see some kids move into selective mutism as well related to this. So we believe that having a team who understands the hyper-arousal and the correct interventions and to also assist in working on that development of self-regulation is really integral to help these kids.
So you mentioned that parents should begin something as early as elementary school with addressing this. Can you give us specific examples of what parents might either like do themselves at home or some goals that they could set up at the school?
Absolutely. Really what we want to start with really young kids is the level of awareness and kind of helping them and the teachers and professionals around them to connect the dots around what happens when you see hyperarousal occurring, and then what are the tools that might affect that and help to reduce it. And so even in young kids, and sometimes we can start this even, you know, quite young, where we, just like you were doing with Ian, you know, in the kitchen where he's getting kind of hyper and anxious and he doesn't know what to do, and then you offer him a solution. But it's kind of being a little bit, I guess, really plain and explicit and clear with them about the fact that, you know, I see you. You know, oh, you're excited. Let's help you settle down so that we can read this book. So some of it is just helping to kind of create that cause-effect kind of relationship around when you're a little hyper-aroused, here's what you can do about it. And with little kids, we might do that in a really simple way. We've also developed this one strategy that we use even with children as young as 2 or 3, and as old, and we use the same strategy even with adults, and it's this ready, not ready.
Right. And so what we do is we might present the child or the adult when they're becoming a little anxious and hyper-aroused with a small square, and on one side of it, a laminated square, there's a red circle, on the other side is a green circle. And we might say to them, oh, I'm not ready to do my work now, or I'm not ready to play with the other kids, or I'm not ready to go to the next classroom. But you know what? I need to get ready, so let's figure out what we need to do to get ready. So we're using that red and green system as sort of a stop and go, but what's more important is we're addressing the fact that we need to figure out what we need to do to get ready to move to the next activity.
So you're saying when the child is not ready, you show them the red, and they choose if they're ready or not ready, or you choose if they're ready or not ready?
What we do is we use some of that self-talk as a way of expressing what they're feeling at the time. Oh, you're not ready. I can tell that. You're not ready. Well, let's figure out what we need to do to get ready. So you're really being their voice, and you're helping pair whatever the words are that you're using with the biological state that they're experiencing.
And really the base of self-regulation is learning that stop and start signal. So the stop is the red light, and it's the not ready. You know, you're getting you're a little worried to go into the grocery store. You're not ready. And then you show them the red light. And then you turn it over and you say, let's get ready. And then you say, I know what works for me. I think if I push the cart and chew some gum and have my list of the three things I need to shop for, that's going to help me in the grocery store, and then I won't be so nervous. So let's get ready. Let's get the cart. Let's get our list. Let's get some gum. Okay, I think we're ready now. And so it's really about helping them to stop and evaluate what's going on, why am I feeling overwhelmed, and then making a plan to approach whatever the demand is that's on them. So it's stopping, organizing yourself, and then moving into approach or moving into action. And that process is really the fundamental process that we refer to as self-regulation. So it's never about stopping and just being overwhelmed and now I can't function. It's about figuring out what to do and moving on. So we think we can teach that, and we actually know we successfully work with very young kids and elementary age kids, middle school kids, adults that all have learned how to do this really successfully.
I can see how that would really work as an adult too, because if you learn that when you're a child, you know, just in their own mind, when they are someplace and they don't have, you know, they're more by themselves, they can think, okay, I'm not ready, what do I need to do? And it'll just become a pattern in their own mind.
Absolutely. And then, you know, what we do, Lorene, is we often expand that basic ready, not ready model into this little strategy that we call the five-finger approach. And basically, it's just an expansion of that. So because people with Fragile X really are visual and they need those visual supports, their hand can be a visual. And so what we teach them is that they stop and grab their thumb, and that's the stop signal, just like the red light or the not ready sign. And then the second finger, they go to their second finger and hold it, and they squeeze it, and they take a deep breath. Because learning how to take a deep breath is really one of the most basic self-regulatory skills that we have to have for our whole life. And it's one that interrupts the hyperarousal that's happening in the brain, and it can help to slow it down and to put it into check. So that deep breath is really an important skill that's kind of an adjunct. We haven't talked about it yet to this point in our podcast, but we know that that deep breath is really fundamental. And so then the next finger, so you have five fingers on your hand. The first one is stop. Second is take a deep breath. The third one is to ask yourself, what's wrong? So that's kind of building on that stop signal. You know, what's going on? Why am I having a hard time here? Is it too loud? Am I not sure what to do? Is somebody bugging me? Whatever the problem might be. And then the fourth finger is, well, what am I going to do about that? So that's making that plan to get ready. It's the same function, it's just a little elaborated. And then the fifth finger is to do that action. Okay, now I need to push the cart into the store, or I need to ask for quiet, or I need to go take a cold drink, or I need to watch a TV show and get my act together, or whatever it is. So that's the process of self-regulation that we teach with that five-finger approach.
So, and I think that's a wonderful approach. I can see how it would be very effective. And the only question I can think of is, or maybe one of the questions is, so, like, if you're on the fourth one, what do I need to do about this? Then I know you talked about using self-talk about, talking about what I would do, like as a parent. Then how do you make that transition from getting the child to do that or to come up with ideas for him or her?
Mm-hmm. Well, I guess we should back up and talk about why we use self-talk. We tend to use that in the moment when the child is experiencing the hyperarousal, because at that point, because they are hyperaroused,
so difficult for them to use their words to describe how they're feeling or to make a request because they're quite disorganized. So we know that also individuals with Fragile X are great indirect learners. And so we know that if we say something and we don't direct it directly at them, they'll still be listening and taking that information in. So that's why we use something like self-talk. And then as we gradually work through, as a parent, if I come up with a strategy that I think works well for them, like, oh my gosh, I'm feeling really anxious and hyper aroused and worried. I think I need to do my yoga that I learned in school. And then, and you also know that the individual child has learned something like that, and that is a specific strategy that works for him. So what we try to do is we try to match the strategy with what works for the child. I mean, if they need some deep pressure input and that is something that's powerful to help shift that hyper arousal, then we'll come up with strategies that meet that specific need.
And, you know, Jane, earlier you were talking about some things that you've learned, some tools you've learned to use with Ian, like, you know, movement on a therapy ball or a weighted blanket or things like that. And you know, what's interesting is most of the tools that we're going to put in to a person's self-regulation program, they end up being best selected really with the help of a therapist. And then the therapist can turn that information over to the family. But if you just go through, like, you know, like Lois Hickman and I years ago wrote this list of calming strategies for people with Fragile X. And, you know, we still use that all the time. It was published in a couple different books, and the Foundation uses it, I think, as a handout pretty frequently. And we love having that resource for people to look at, like, you know, what really is calming, what generally helps promote self-regulation. But it's always going to be individual, and it's often better if the family just get an OT assessment to get the input around what really are going to be the biggest powerhouses for that individual at the current time, because it's just a little bit more effective that way. And and those tools are things that are going to be learned kind of over time, you know. So there's so many layers to this, and we want to make it simple for people. Really what we're talking about is the tools have to be taught to the child and to the family, and then those would be things like calming input or yoga or deep breaths or using heavy work strategies or any of those general ideas.
I get calls from families or group homes or different facilities who have people with Fragile X that are in their 60s. Are these techniques something that can be, I mean, obviously they can be taught any time, but are they helpful to even somebody who is somebody of that age able to pick up what they need from that?
Absolutely they are. And a lot of times what we'll do is we'll create like a little visual catalog for people, whether it be pictures that they have posted on a bulletin board in their work site or in their bedroom, or maybe their little photos that they carry around with them on a card in their wallet or clipped to a keychain, or something like that that they carry with them. So sometimes they might have that visual, like, when I'm distressed, here are my choices. Here are things I know to do. Because just like Mouse was explaining that in states of arousal, language is organized, well, so does that problem-solving skills. So trying to decide, you know, what do I do when I'm really stressed might be on the person if they don't have a visual support to remind them of the tools that they know and that they have access to.
That's a great idea. Even having the keychain, I could see how that would work just having them know it's in their pocket and that they have choices available, because I can see my sons being able to pull that out and just holding it will remind them that there are other options for them than what they're feeling.
Absolutely.
I think that's right.
That's right.
A great idea. That's a great idea.
Yeah, that's why we like that five-finger strategy, too, because if we do it a ton at home or at school or at the workplace, then they really, every time they grab their thumb, they're going to remember, oh, yeah, I'm supposed to stop and take a deep breath here and help myself. That set of skills is, you know, something that once you learn how to use it, there's this sort of drive to use it. Like any of us, if you learn something, you want to use it. And when they learn how to cope and how to regulate, they really feel empowered about it.
Hi, this is Robbie Miller again. We talked about the title, self-regulation, but the other part of the title of today's podcast is across the lifespan. So does that suggest that these issues are issues from infancy through adulthood?
They absolutely are, yeah. And we think, you know, a few years ago we were doing a talk with a panel, and we had a chance to do this presentation with Dr. Alan Reese from Stanford, and he said, you know, self-regulation problems and hyperarousal are the most pervasive problem in across the lifespan. And I think Mouse jumped up and down with joy to hear somebody else talk about that, like, and really say, yes, this is a huge problem across the lifespan, because that's one of our theme songs for, you know, 20 years. But, yeah, we see it as a problem even in young as children are identified, you know, infants. They really do. They show more problems with sleeping and feeding, regulating their basic states of awake and alert, and they have a harder time getting organized when they're little babies, to be able to use their hands and to play and things like that. And so we see it very early, and then we see it all the way through the lifespan. So we've had a chance to work with a lot of and really see that they can continue to learn these skills. And what's fascinating is that as we've had a chance to work with adults and put in really a lot of regulation programming for them, we've seen adults who were nonverbal at a talk in their 30s because they were organized enough to show this skill that was kind of hiding underneath all of the hyperarousal. I think it's really like an issue that often gets ignored, or people just attribute it to behavior and eventually try to just treat it with medication. But it's really something that we see across the lifespan, and we know that intervention for adults is just as important as it is for kids.
How would your intervention change for an adult, for example? Like if somebody was really struggling with it in their 20s, where would you start with the 20-year-old?
Well, usually what we do in that situation, we would work with them. We would sort out where are they living, where are they working, what is their life of, what are the challenges that they're facing, what skills do they have and do they not have. And then we figure out, do they need to learn that in a direct therapy kind of situation, or is it better by setting up support work and having a job coach, you know, learn the information and incorporate it into their day, or having parents revisit how would they, put these tools in place into their daily life so they can impart it to their child. So it's really kind of evaluation process initially.
Right. And we've been lucky enough to work with a variety of cognitive impairments,
very high functioning adults to some very, very low functioning adults. And we've been able to infuse some of these self-regulation for all of them. So we're very lucky that this is something that can be in their lives, be more successful at work or in their apartment living situation and things like that.
That's really exciting.
Okay. Well, we've covered a lot of ground today. I wondered if there were any last insights, questions, comments from any of you that can add to the already wonderful insight you've provided on self-regulation.
I'd like to make a comment, and just that we get a lot of emails and phone calls about sort of emergency situations, like I had to take my child to the hospital for their routine checkup at the Fragile X clinic, and I couldn't get him through the door, or we did a blood draw, and then that was the end of the entire visit. So there, we encounter so many of these types of situations in our lifetime with our families, whether it's the blood draw, whether it's a visit to the doctor's office, or things that, you know, visiting someone at Thanksgiving who the child may not like very much. So we have to remember that it's so important to keep these self-regulation strategies in place throughout the lifetime. It's the proactive use of these that are going to help the kids on a more regular basis to deal with some of these more emergency situations.
You know, and I wanted to mention, too, that even once these children learn these self-regulation techniques, you know, say they're going to school and everything's in place and they understand everything before they're getting on the bus and getting home, sometimes changing that starts the process all over again. So you might feel confident that they know how to handle a situation, but if you change the place, change the people, you might still need to put those supports back into place.
Absolutely. You know, keeping them active, keeping them appropriate for the situations that the person is finding themselves in. You know, elementary school is different than middle school. And like you're learning, Lorene, you know, the adult world is very different. And keeping those tools in place and keeping them fresh and using the resources of the therapist in your life to make sure that you're being really proactive is really central to this. And keeping in mind that self-regulation is one of the things that allows a person to function. It allows the person to be in their communities and have jobs and have relationships with people and participate in fun, enriched lives. And when they don't have those skills, it can really be detrimental to their independence and to the positivity of their life. So we know that it's just very central to daily functioning, and we hope that people are excited to put in place the programs that are going to really promote self-regulation.
I'd like to just throw in one thing, too. One thing that I've seen with my son when I see his anxiety start to go up, and I see him migrate towards an activity like I mentioned earlier, whether it be swinging or walking away or going through the five finger process is acknowledging that he did that and he was successful. It's like that.
Absolutely.
You know, that's you did it. You know, you did it. You made a good choice. It looks like you're feeling better. We're ready to move on. He's not one to, you know, you can't get too excited about it because then his anxiety goes back up again. But, you know, if you just say, wow, nice job, then he looks and he goes, thanks. And that's, you know, sometimes that's all it takes.
That's beautiful.
Okay, well, I think we're going to end today's podcast. Those of you who've been listening to the podcast or will be listening, you can send comments and questions to podcast@fragilex.org. Again, podcast@fragilex.org. So thank you, Laureen Majewski. Thank you, Jane Dixon Weber. Thank you, Tracy Stackhouse. Thank you, Sarah Mouse Scharfenegger. This has been a National Fragile X Foundation podcast, and we look forward to having future ones with all of you and hearing your presentations at upcoming conferences around the country. Take care. Thank you.